Translation. The remaining trees, being very afraid of the potatoes, immediately delivered their daughter at the advice of Lord Brahma. Commentary by Srila Prabhupada. The daughter of the trees is referred to in the text 13 of this chapter. This daughter was born of Kandu and Pramlocha. The society girl, Pramlocha, after giving birth to the child, immediately left for the heavenly kingdom. While the child was crying, the king of the moon took compassion upon her and saved her by putting his finger into his mouth. Sorry, into her mouth. This child was cared for by the trees, and when she grew up, by the order of Lord Brahma, she was delivered to the Prachetas as their wife. The name of the girl was Marisha. As the next verse will explain, it was the predominating deity of the trees that delivered the daughter. In this connection, Srila Jiva Goswami Prabhupada states, Vriksha tad adishta drita deva. The trees means the controlling deity of the trees. In the Vedic literature, we find there is a controlling deity of the water. Similarly, there is a controlling deity of the trees. The Prachetas were engaged in burning all of the trees to ashes, as they considered the trees their enemies. To pacify the Prachetas, the predominating deity of the trees, under the advice of Lord Brahma, delivered the daughter Marisha. Om again, Timurandasya, Gananjana, Shalakaya, Chakshurun Militam Jaina, Tasmai, Shri Guruve Namaha, Mukham Karoti Vachalam, Pongum Langayate Girim, Yatkripa Tamaham Vande, Shri Guru Ninatarnam, Shri Rupa, Shri Sanatana, Bhattaraguna, Shri Jiva Gopal Bhatta Dasa Raguna, Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Jena Bhutale, Sayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dharati Saparantikam, Vande Shri Krishna Chaitanya Nityanando Suhoruto, Gaudadaye Pushpavantu Chitro Sando Tamonudo, Namo Mahavaranyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate, Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gaurutvishe Namaha Tavasmi Radhikanatha Karmana Manasagiram Krishna Kante Tavaivasmi Yuvame Vagatir Mama Govinda Vallabhe Radhe Partheye Tvamaham Sadam Tvariyayati Janatu Govindo Mam Tvayasaha Radhe Vrindavanadishe Karudamrita Vahini Kripaya Nijapadaja Dasyam Mahyam Pradiyatam Tavaivasmi Najivami Tvayavinam Iti Vigyaya Devitvam Nayamam Charanantigam Vanchakalpatarupyascha Kripasindubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So here in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, we are reading a very dramatic account of, for those of you who are not yet familiar with the story as it's unfolding, because this is just one verse out of many in a grand narrative. The sons, these are princes, the sons of a king named Prachinabarhi. They have been sent by their father to go and perform penance and austerity in order to gain blessings and investment, that is power, to perform their role as princes, to rule the earth, also to generate progeny that will continue the line of succession for their kingdom. And in this, they have met Shiva, who gave them a prayer that they could chant in order to invoke the blessings of Lord Narayan, of Lord Vishnu or Krishna. And so they chanted that prayer with great devotion. They had darshan, shakshad darshan, of Lord Narayan, who was very pleased with them, gave them his benedictions. And they were meditating in the sea. And once they had concluded their penance and austerity, they emerged from the sea and saw that the entire earth had been covered by trees in their absence. And as rulers, as princes, as administrators, it is their duty or responsibility to ensure there is a proper balance and a harmony on earth. And when they saw that everything had become wild and overgrown by the trees, they felt that this was an infringement, an overstepping of boundaries by the trees, making wilderness everywhere, wildlife everywhere. And in their anger, fire emerged from their mouths. That's how potent they were. And they began to burn the trees to ashes. But then they overstepped the boundary and they decided to burn all the trees. That's what happens when we're angry. When we're angry, then we lose our intelligence. So reason goes out the window and emotion becomes prominent. Therefore, Krishna advises us in the Bhagavad Gita. He describes an unfolding, a process whereby lust leads to attachment, or contemplation leads to lust, which leads to attachment, and then anger, bewilderment of memory. When you get angry and emotional, your memory is lost, you're confused, and Krishna says it concludes with madness and falling down into this negative downward cycle or spiral that he calls a material, proper translates as a material whirlpool. Krodha or anger, karma and krodha, they go together, lust and anger, lust, anger, greed. These things unfold together, they're all related, they're relatives. And Arjuna asks Krishna how to curb this. Krishna says it's difficult, but it is possible. By how? Who remembers what?
Practice and detachment.
Yeah. By practice and by detachment. Now, how do you nurture detachment? Yes, Abhishek. That's the best answer. preliminary to that might be reason. When you can understand things in a rational way, in a philosophical way, then we become a little more detached from the situation. So our emotions and our senses might be saying, "I want this, and I must have it." But then, if we contemplate consequences, then we can understand with our intelligence that actually that's not a good idea. It's not healthy for me. It may not be healthy for others, for the environment, and so on. So cultivating philosophical understanding of things, understanding things in terms of future consequences. So that means present, past, present, future considerations. What's happened in the past when I engaged with this thing? Oh. What has happened in the past when others engaged in this way? So that's thinking in relation to the past and then the future. The future, what might happen if I do it now? What would be the likely consequences? So practice and detachment means to nurture, in fact, higher spiritual understanding. Practice that, you'll get the higher taste. So detachment relates to philosophical understanding. Practice relates to getting that higher taste that you spoke of. Because philosophical understanding is not enough. It just remains intellectual. It remains theoretical. But when you practice it, you practice that detachment, that withholding, then you can appreciate, oh, this is actually a much better thing. Imagine if I had have done that, or see how others have done that. And so you get a higher taste in applying that philosophical understanding. So practice, detachment. They relate to philosophical understanding and higher taste. So the Prachetas, they are overwhelmed by emotion and anger. Brahma has come to reason with them. When there is disorder in the world, the devas generally go to Brahmaji because he is the creator. So he's overseeing things with his four heads. And when he can't deal with it, then he takes them to Vishnu, the ultimate authority. So Brahma, he's come to reason with them, and that was described in the verse yesterday, how he used logic to pacify and reason with them. And now in this verse, we read that once Brahma had reasoned with them and they've withdrawn their anger, then the remaining trees who are afraid, they're giving their daughter at Brahma's advice. So that's their peace offering, huh? Brahma's told the Prachetas to withdraw, and then also he's advised the tree, you've also done wrong. So it's not that the Prachetas are, the trees are wrong, therefore the Prachetas have a right to over-punish them. The Prachetas are wrong, the trees are wrong. Brahma's advising them both to make amends. So that's also very instructive for us. Because sometimes when somebody makes a mistake, we might feel justified in, to some extent, rightly justified in our anger towards them, and maybe even some aggression towards them, whether it's passive or active aggression. But then we end up in the same wrong. So two wrongs don't make a right. The trees did wrong, the Prachetas ended up doing wrong. Brahma's now bringing them together and having them both make amends. And so the trees, they've offered their daughter. Now, interestingly, the Sanskrit word here for daughter is? Who can pick it from the verse? It's on the board. No, that's tree. That's all right. It's good to have it. It's good on you for having a go.
Uttaras?
No. I think Uttaras is getting up or enthusiasm. I heard someone just say it. No, Prachetabhya is of the Prachetas. Duhitra. So what does that sound like? Daughter. That's the same word. Duhitra and daughter. It's the same word, right? So many of our words in English, they come from Sanskrit. Pita and father, mata and mother, duhitra and daughter.
Brother also.
Brother. Ratra. And not only, manushya, of mankind, or, yeah, so descendants of Manu are called man or mankind. So this is also significant, this relationship, indicating this relationship in language. Many years ago, the British, they were colonizing the earth, different parts of the earth, and they believed they were justified in doing this on account that they had a higher civilization. So they had literature, they had music, they had poetry, they had monotheistic religion. And so they would go to Africa and to America and civilize tribal people. So they felt they were doing a good thing for the world. And yeah, that's how they justified, rationalized their imperialism. When they came to India, it was a little bit of a different story, because here there was sophisticated literature. Bhagavad Purana, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Vedas. There was very sophisticated music, drama, language. there was monotheistic religions. So it was very difficult for them to rationalize and justify what they were doing in India with this colonization project. Then this became was made even more complicated when they discovered the similarities in the Sanskrit language with the English language. Not only with English, but all European languages. Not just the modern languages, but the more ancient Latin and Greek. They found to be very closely related, and in fact, the same languages, just that they have developed differently. And it appeared that, so the languages were at least sister languages, but Sanskrit was in fact the older cousin or the older relative there. So it became even more, so this made it even more difficult to rationalize and justify who's the older civilization, who has more civilization, which is the more advanced civilization here. And so then they ended up concocting a theory to explain this, because it was just too uncomfortable. We and Indians, Europeans and Indians, are related. We share the same language. We're the same. We're the same. I beg your pardon? Philosophy? Not necessarily philosophy, but the same people. We're the same people. And in fact, the Indians might be the older brothers. Very uncomfortable for a colonial power. Knowing that the people they're supposedly ruling are the older, more advanced civilization. So how did they deal with this? They concocted a theory that probably most of you have been taught. And that is a theory of an Aryan invasion. That, yes, we are cousins, we are brothers, our languages are related, but how are they related? Sanskrit can't really be the mother language. It can be a sister, but not the mother language. There is, in fact, an older language. There must be, theoretically, there must be an older language called... Anyone familiar with this language? Devanagari? That's another name for Sanskrit.
Aramaic?
No. No. Indo-European. There must be, hypothetically, an older language called Indo-European, which is in fact the source language. And so from Indo-European, you have Sanskrit branch off here, you have Latin, Greek, and then German, French, English over there. But so, yes, we are all related, but we're related to this older culture. It can't be that Sanskrit and then Greek, Latin, German, French, English, Italian. So they concocted this, or they hypothesized this idea of this ancient Indo-European language. No one's ever seen it. No one's ever found a tablet or a script or a manuscript written in Indo-European. But in fact, if you read any textbook, current textbook, of Indian civilization, you will find this to be the official account. The Indo-European people, where did they live? Well, it has to be somewhere between India and Europe. Whatever. So somewhere between India and Europe, where would that be? That's kind of the Caucasus region. So what's today the Caucasus region of Russia? Near to the Caspian Sea. That's the cradle of our joint civilizations, the Indo-European people. So the from the Caucasian... Europeans are called Caucasians, so we come from that Caucasus region. But that apparently, according to this theory, is the source of the Indo-Europe. It's the place, the homeland of the Indo-European people, Some migrated Europe towards the direction of Europe, and others towards India. And these were the Aryans who invaded India, coming down from the north, from the Caucasus region, which is in fact Europe, coming down from the north into India, and then defeating the Dravidian people and establishing the Aryan Vedic culture. So there you have it. Now you know. Now you know your origins. Many, many problems. Although this is the official account that you will read in any textbook of the history of India, the history of India's religions, not just by Europeans, but by Indian scholars, Indian Indologists, it's a totally different account than what the Veda itself teaches us. The Veda has no such description. But this is the, this is the correct idea, according to the scholars, even Indian scholars of academics. This is the official account. So it's a complete speculation. It just comes from the colonialists needing a way to justify and rationalize their colonial rule in India. That's basically where it comes from. Here's some of the other, because here are some of the other problems with the theory. There is no archaeological evidence for it. So if there is a civilization moving down from the Caucasus, from Europe, coming into India, there might be some archaeological evidence, whatever that might be, encampments along the way. If they came down as armies, an invading army, there might be, you know, arrowheads and, you know, remnants of their weaponry and so on. There is no evidence of that. So there's no archaeological evidence for the theory. There is no. The other problem is that they say that this happened in a certain time. The Aryans brought the Vedas with them into India, or created the Vedas with them as they were coming into India. And it happened in a certain historical period. I don't remember dates. I'm not a. I don't have a mathematical mind. So they have a date for this. The Veda describes a Saraswati river. Any good Hindu growing up in India or out of India, they've heard glory, the glorification of the Saraswati River, one of the great India, one of the great rivers of India. Ganga, Yamuna, Godavari, Sindhu, Kaveri, Saraswati. These are the great sacred rivers of India. And but we don't find the Saraswati River flowing anymore in India. We have the Ganga. We take Ganga Snan. We have the at Gangotri, at Mayapur. We have the Yamuna, still barely flowing. You can take nice bath at Yamunotri. But by the time she gets to Vrindavan, she's been terribly polluted. And by some accounts, the water of the Yamuna has pretty much, the water from Yamunotri, by the time it reaches Vrindavan, it's all been taken out and replaced with the sewage and other pollutions. Very, very sad. But to continue with this point, we have the Ganga, we have the Yamuna, we have the Narmada. And although the Saraswati is glorified throughout the Veda, the Vedic texts, we don't have a physical Saraswati River flowing in India today. Although it is said that at Triveni in Prayag, where the Yamuna and Ganga meet, then the Saraswati, she's also there flowing underneath. So in a spiritual way, she's there, but as a great, mighty river, We don't have the Saraswati flowing on the Indian subcontinent. However, there is an extensive riverbed, a dried up riverbed, with many ancient cities. These are archaeological underground cities that have been excavated. There is a series of cities along this great riverbed that is the that appears within the region as described in the Vedic text. Is this making sense? Yeah. So the region, the Vedas, they describe the Ganga, the Yamuna, where they flow. Yeah. So we know from Mahabharata, Yamuna flows through Vrindavan. We know that near to Hastinapur, the Ganga was flows. So there are descriptions of the places where these rivers flow. There are descriptions of where the Saraswati flows. There's a riverbed there, but it dried up long ago. And according to... and then there are the great cities along that riverbed. These cities were abandoned when the Saraswati River dried up. When did she dry up? She dried up long before the date given for the Aryan invasion. And yet, these Indologists, scholars, they describe how the Aryans brought the Veda into India and kind of created the Veda along their way. The Veda describes different battles between Indra and the Asuras. That was, in fact, that's actually their literary basis for this theory. It's actually describing the Aryan invasion, the battles of Indra and the Asuras. So although the Veda describes the Saraswati as a flowing river, the Saraswati River, as it stands in India, dried up thousands and thousands and thousands of years before the date that the Indologists give for the Aryan invasion. Is that making sense? Did I like bamboozle you or confuse you? Or you got it? Yeah. So, so this is the problem with this modern. But when we speculate, their theory was created for political reasons, and the theory continues to be perpetuated today because that is the established theory, for no other reason than that. And although it has so many holes in it, I've described some of them, there are other more detailed holes to this theory. Yes?
They also claim that horses were never in India.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why they think it's moved from there is because horses originated in that Central Europe and
okay.
Middle East kind of area. And they also claim that in Armenia they have found some archaeological evidence of some cart, which is what is described in the Veda as the chariot. Michael Wood has presented that in the story of India.
Okay.
He goes, travels there, and says we found some archaeological evidence and stuff like that.
Okay, so good. You are very familiar with all of these concepts and ideas. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for... when we take the Vedic account on its own merit, it's a much more strong argument. And that is the tradition, that is the position that we take. That has always been Srila Prabhupada's argument. Let the tradition speak for itself. Right? The tradition has an account. The Veda has an account of its origin. The Bhagavatam has an account of its origin. Why must we disregard the Bhagavatam's account and privilege the account of someone of today? Based on their speculations. why is the speculation of the academic today in the university superior to the account of the rishis and the yogis and the gurus and the acharyas? Why is the account of the academic of today privileged over Ramanujacharya, privileged over Srila Madhvacharya, privileged over Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, privileged over Bhaktivinoda Thakur, privileged over Srila Prabhupada? Because the tradition also says one other thing, that is that these things cannot be understood just by intellectualization. If you intellectually can recount these 700 verses of the Gita, but don't understand within your heart that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you don't know the Bhagavad Gita. You may know the words, but you don't know the Bhagavad Gita. Because you don't know it in your heart. You haven't realized it. The Bhagavad Gita is known intellectually, it is practiced, and then it is realized. Krishna himself gives the understanding by which you can come to me. What does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? Shining with the torch of knowledge, I enter into their heart. I enter into their heart with the torch of knowledge. This is not an intellectual thing. It's a spiritual thing. So how Ramanuja and Madhva and Sri Chaitanya understand the Veda is not just intellectually, but it is by practice and realization. Krishna tells Arjuna himself, Bhaktosi me saka cheti rahasyam hiyatad utamam. So if we study the Veda, but don't experience the Veda in our own lives, the transcendence of the Veda, we don't know it. So the account of the rishis, the account of the acharyas, is so much more important than that of the academics, which is limited in that it is not revealed. It is based on our own social conditioning, political conditioning, emotional conditioning. And so the mystery, the magic of the Gita is lost to these persons. The magic of the Veda is lost in this academic approach to understanding of the Veda. That's why we must hear the Veda from the Acharya. We must hear the Veda from the Bhakta. Then we can understand. The final word in this, the final line of this verse. Upadishta Swayambhuva. Upadishta means advice. Prabhupada translates it as being advised. It is also related to the word Upanishad. Upanishad means to sit near and receive instruction. The Upanishad gives us actually higher understanding, higher spiritual understanding than is given. It is part of the Veda, but it is the part of the Veda which deals more with transcendence. So the Veda Samhita, Rig, Sama, Yajur, Atharva, they deal more with Karmakanda. How to live a pious life, how to perform sacrifices to get pious merits, pious credits for enjoyment in this world, both on earth and in the heavenly realms, the abode of Indra, and so on. That is the focus of the Veda Samhita. It is very flowery, it is very ornamented. The Upanishad deals with transcendence, Brahma Jigyasa, understanding of the triviality of the material world, the triviality, the superficiality of material enjoyment, and the eternity of transcendence, the eternity of spirit. That is the focus of the Upanishad. Now, historically, scholars, Vedic scholars, they have debated with one another, taking these different positions. The Karmakandikas, the Mimamsas, they advocate this living the pious life to get material credits, to enjoy the material world. And the Uttara Mimamsakas, or those who are of this Upanishadic tradition or the Vedantin tradition, they are arguing for renouncing the material world and focusing on transcendence. And historically, these two camps have debated and argued and defeated and one another. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna harmonizes these two ideas. How might he do that? Any ideas?
He says, working on devotion, that's how. Or you could still do karma karmati, work with devotion.
Very good, Keshava. Krishna harmonizes these two ideas in the Bhagavad Gita by saying that true, this material body is temporary, material happiness is temporary, even the devas and the blessings they give are temporary, true. Transcendence, the soul is eternal, renunciation from material life, that is a better path, true. And yet he advises Arjuna to live in the world and be a kshatriya and rule and fight and establish dharma on earth. He advises him against going to the forest, which is the general advice given in the Upanishads. And Arjuna says, I'm confused. He advises him against going to the forest, but he says, nonetheless, you should be a sannyasin. Nonetheless, you should be renounced, but as a kshatriya ruler, person of the world. And Arjuna says, I'm confused. Which one do you want me to do? Do you want me to be a materialistic sense enjoyer? Do you want me to be a tyagi, renunciant? Krishna says, both. Hello, make up your mind. This has been debated. Even in Hindu society today, many young Indian boys here, your parents may have told you, why are you wanting to renounce and go to the Hare Krishna Mandir? You stay at home. Later on, when you are older, that is the time for study of Upanishads and renunciation. Is it not? Yeah, your parents are probably giving you that advice. Krishna is telling Arjuna to do both. It's not one or the other, or this one's good for now, and then another one's good for later on in life. Do the two together. He tells Arjuna, be a responsible, be a kshatriya, karma eva adhikar, you engage with the world because that's your inclination. It was not your inclination. If it wasn't his inclination, he would advise him something else. You be a tyagi, you, in the physical sense of it, live in the forest. But for Arjuna, he's saying, you don't do that because it's not your nature, you won't be able to maintain it. But internally, your consciousness, you should be cultivating a sense of detachment. You engage with the world, but you understand that it is temporary. You engage with this body and senses and those bodies and senses of other people, but know that you are a soul. You work hard for different goals and objectives in life. But the fruits of all of that you offer to me. You offer that to me. So you fight now and you win this kingdom. But don't think of it as your kingdom. You know it's temporary. You're only here for a short period. Whose is it? It's Krishna's. So you live in that kingdom, you rule that kingdom as a servant of Krishna. You establish Dharma in society that the citizens can live peacefully and prosper as devotees. You're sacrificing the results to Krishna. So this is the harmony that Krishna establishes in the Bhagavad Gita. To be in the world but not of the world. To be actively engaged in society but at the same time detached and aloof from it. Krishna says that is sannyas. He says, that is a sannyasi. He says, the sannyasi is one who engages but sacrifices the results. He says, that is better than the one who, lights no fire?
Performs
no work and lights no fire, something like that. So the Veda is the Purva Mimamsa, and the Upanishad, that is the Uttar Mimamsa. Different ideas, but actually these two ideas, they harmonize beautifully. For the Grihastha, then what is taught in the Veda, that might be more relevant for them at that stage of life. For the sannyasi, the vanaprastha, what is taught in the Upanishad becomes more prominent at their stage of life. But nonetheless, Krishna is teaching us that through all stages of life, you can bring these two. You should bring these two things together. Finally, Brahma, he's described here as Swayambhuva. The last word of this verse is Swayambhuva. What does that mean?
Self-born.
Yeah, self-manifest. So, Manu is described as Swayambhu. Brahmaji is described as Swayambhu. See, a word like this is the reason why the academic would say that, well, yeah, what does that mean? It can't be true, so we have to find a rational explanation. This is some kind of superstition, a myth. The people of that time, they needed a myth to help them engage with their world. So they have concocted. Why can't it be that he is self-born? Why not? It is beyond your limited sensory purview, but that doesn't rule it out as a possibility. Because you can't see it. Hello? How egocentric is that? If I didn't see it, it doesn't exist. There's a big world out there. What our senses, it's like the tuning of a radio. If you're tuned to a certain frequency, then you can hear a certain station, plane. Our senses are tuned to a certain frequency of color. They are tuned to a certain frequency for sound. They are tuned to a frequency for flavor. There are sounds that we cannot hear. There are colors that we cannot see. I beg your pardon?
The dog whistle, isn't it?
The dog whistle, we cannot hear. The dog hears, we cannot hear. There are aromas that we cannot smell. The dog smells. There's a lot of sensory data out there that our senses have no access to. It's just beyond our sensory purview because our senses are not attuned to it. Whereas certain animals, certain species, they will be tuned to that spectrum of frequency, color, sound, light, aroma, and so on. Aside from that, there is a spiritual dimension. That unless you are attuned spiritually, unless you have attuned your spiritual, you don't see it, you don't experience it. That requires refining of the spiritual senses. So just because you have no experience of someone who is self-born does not mean that it cannot be. So how Brahma is self-born? He's self-born on a lotus flower. In fact, he's born from the Nabi, Padmanabha, the lotus that sprouts from the Nabha, the Nabi of Lord Narayan. Garbo Dakashayi Vishnu. The academic will discredit all of that. And so therefore they have no access. And then they have to manufacture some myth. They have their myths. Aryan invasion is a myth. Their theories about the origin of the Veda, they are myths. And their dating, they can give a dating based on what? Based on language. So, is this engaging for you? Yeah. So you have the Vedic text. It is written in a sort of Sanskrit. It's all written in Sanskrit, but there are different. Not just the script. It's the style of the language. So if you read Shakespearean English today, it's very hard to access. Even how the script that it is written in. The spelling is very different. Even the letters that are used are different today than what Shakespeare was writing with. And have you tried reading the original Shakespeare? It's difficult to penetrate, yeah, some of you. So the Veda, it is written in a certain Sanskrit, type of Sanskrit that is called Vedic Sanskrit. It is very... It's very complicated, it is very flowery, it's full of metaphor. And that's something else.
Isn't that different from Vedic and Lokic? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily. Just take Shakespeare as an example, yeah? It's just very poetic. So Vedic Sanskrit is very poetic. It is different when you read Upanishadic Sanskrit. It's a different language. It's Sanskrit, but it is written in a very different way. And then when you read the Puranas, it's different again. Puranic Sanskrit. Then when you read like more modern literature, Sanskrit literature, like Kathasarit Sagara, the dramas, the Kavya texts, it's different again. So then the linguists, they calculate, well, how long does it take for a language to morph historically? So if we would go back to, you know, the early Australian settlers, what English they were speaking, it's different than how people speak today. Hey, yo, what's up, man? So it's different language, right? What's up, yo? And so so the early settlers of Australia, they wouldn't understand what you're talking about.
Same with Chaitanya Charitamrita, like the Bengali that it's written, the Bengali that we speak.
Of today, right. So language morphs. Historically, language morphs. So then they calculate how long would it take for a Vedic Sanskrit to morph, for this syllable to become that, to become the Upanishads. How long would it take for that to morph to become the Puranas? How long would that take to morph to become the form of Sanskrit that is the more modern Sanskrit literature? And then they give dating. If this is this, if it took this long to morph to that, then so then the Veda must be 4,000 years, or whatever it is. I don't know exactly the dates that they give for these things. There's one problem with this idea. If you would base your whole reconstruction of a civilization based on this approach, that is that at any extent time, even with the English language today, you can find different genres that are appropriate to different contexts. What do I mean? I mean that if you go to the news agency and you pick up the Sydney Morning Herald, it's written in a certain style. If you pick up a legal document, is it the same English? No. If you pick up a comic book, is it the same English? No. If you pick up an encyclopedia, is it the same English? No. So here we are in the one news agency today in 2011, and we have an academic report, we have a government report, we have a comic book, and they're all written in English, but they're different. So then to say that this is the history of a civilization based on these different types of Sanskrit, that doesn't work. It's not necessarily the fact. Because when you read Srimad Bhagavatam and you come to the section of the 10th canto called Prayers by the Personified Vedas, have any of you penetrated that section of the Bhagavatam? It's in the Krishna book. There's a Krishna book based on the Bhagavatam. A lot of people, they get to that section and sort of, it's pretty hard going, pretty hard reading. I might like skip over and get to the next story. It's written in Vedic Sanskrit. When you get to the prayers by the personified Vedas, they're praying to Krishna in the womb of Devaki. It's in the Bhagavatam. When they offer their prayers, it's not in Puranic Sanskrit, it's in Vedic Sanskrit.
Especially the first words of Brahma, saying Krishna, you're not true.
Yeah. Sounds like you like that verse. It's written in a different language. Sanskrit language, but in a different genre of language. So here within one Puranic text, we have a different usage of language because that is the genre. That's the Vedas speaking. And when the Vedas speak, that's how they talk. So these are problems. These are problems with the modern approach to trying to understand the Veda. Prabhupada disregards that approach and encourages us, not just encourage, insists that we study the Veda as it has been studied for millennia. That is through the parampara system of guru and disciple. The parampara system that you sit before the spiritual master and you hear the Veda, you hear the Vedic teaching, The spiritual master is not manufacturing, is not deconstructing, reconstructing historically, etymologically, linguistically, and trying to come up with their own account of things, but just teaching the Veda as the Veda itself describes itself. Then you can start to penetrate the mystery. You can start to realize and experience the mystery of what is taught here. So we'll take any, like, two questions. One from Sri Goloka.
Yesterday you mentioned about the philosophical systems.
Yeah.
Is Nyaya the same as Anuman? Or is there a difference?
Is Nyaya the same as?
Anuman.
Anuman.
Reasoning.
I guess so. You could make that relationship. Yeah, I mean, Anuman, hypotheticals, intellectualization, speculation, so you could make that association, but it's generally, they're not, Nyaya engages Anuman, yeah? Nyaya engages that rational, logical thinking. So, yes. Good. Okay, one more. Adikesha Prabhu.
Why are we reading the activities of Prachetas? What's the significance?
Well, the Bhagavatam tells us narrations of Krishna and Krishna's devotees. And how Krishna engages with his devotees. The relationship with the devotees. So that's basically what Bhagavatam is. And then as we study Bhagavatam, we see different types of relationships. And it brings us from passive relationships to more active, more intimate, and then most intimate. All of these accounts, they show us applied spiritual knowledge. So they are exemplars. When you read the Upanishad, it's all theoretical, it's all philosophical. When you read Bhagavad Gita, it's all philosophical, you know, theoretical, philosophical, just laying out the tattva. When we read Bhagavatam, then we have examples. How Krishna is the Supreme Personality. Well, he appeared before the Prachetas. How did that happen? Well, they chanted a prayer. What prayer did they chant? They chanted a prayer that was taught to them by their guru, Lord Shiva. So we see the philosophy applied in these Bhagavatam accounts. So it brings the Bhagavatam to life. And then Chaitanya Charitamrita shows us how people of our time, 500 years, it's not such a great expanse of time, how they applied Srimad Bhagavatam in their lives, in our time, in Kali Yuga. So, Chaitanya Charitamrita and all the books of the Goswamis, they are in many ways a commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah. So the significance is that they prayed, they had darshan of Krishna. And so their lives are special, they're exemplary. We have much to learn from these accounts. Okay, that's it, thanks. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki jai, Nitai Gaur Premanandi.